the nuclear arms race in a series of four different presentations. This is the first one, and tonight I'd like to ask the question, what would nuclear war be like, and is it likely to happen? Can everybody hear me at that level? Do I need to talk more loudly for those of you in the back? A little bit? I can do that, but I get lazy if I don't need to talk loudly. I'd like to just begin by sharing a bit of how I got into this issue personally. I've just finished a book on the nuclear arms race called Nuclear Holocaust and Christian Hope, which is not out yet, but will be in a couple months. And I did that book in part because a friend of mine said to me about 3.5 years ago, after I had written a book called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, he said, Ron, the world has existed with poverty for centuries, and we'll get along with a lot of poverty for another 50 years or 100 years. And it's not that he was callous about poverty. He cares a lot about it, and he lives consistently with caring about it. But he said, we won't survive another 25 years of the nuclear arms race, and I'd like to encourage you to write a book about that. Well, I laughed at first, but the more I thought about it, the more I prayed about it, the more I decided that, in fact, that's what I was supposed to do. So I have done that, and I'll be sharing out of that book. Someone suggested that I ought to call the nuclear book Radiant Christians in a Nuclear Age. I didn't do that. About a little more than 2 years ago, 2.5, I guess, I had an interesting opportunity to be in the White House with then-President Jimmy Carter. And there were about 15 of us having breakfast there, and we were talking about a number of things. The first thing, actually, that came up in the time of question and discussion with the President was the question of the nuclear arms race. And someone was concerned that if a nuclear war broke out, the Russians were way ahead of us, and they would only lose a few people, and we would lose many, many more, and they thought that we were not adequately prepared. And they asked the President what he was doing about that. Well, Carter said, first of all, my data does not agree with yours, but he didn't make a point of that. He went on to say, if the Russians launched an attack, we would be able to detect that in a very short time. And we would also be able to launch a counterattack in a matter of minutes. And then very quietly, he said, and I would do that. Now that was kind of jarring. He was only sitting about as far away as the back of the furthest away from here, from me. And I believe Carter's a Christian. And there was a person that I would have to call a brother in Jesus Christ, saying that he would push the buttons that he knows would kill at least a few million, probably tens of millions, probably hundreds of millions of people. That's the question that we have to struggle with. That's what Carter said when he was trying to run for office. He was trying to persuade those people in his office that day. Most of them had different political views than I do, and so he thought that he could persuade them to vote for him by assuring them that he was doing all he could to rearm the country. When he spoke to the nation the last day in office, Carter spoke what I think is probably was closer to his heart. I want to just quote from that speech. He said, the United States and all countries must find ways to control and reduce the horrifying danger of nuclear weapons. It may be only a matter of time before madness, desperation, greed, or miscalculation lets loose this terrible force. In an all-out nuclear war, he said, more destructive power than in all of World War II would be unleashed every second for the long afternoon that it would take for all the missiles and bombs to fall. The World War II every second, more people killed in the first few hours than in all the wars of history put together. The survivors, if any, would live in despair amid the poisoned ruins of a civilization that had committed suicide. Now, I think we need to deal with this question. It's not a pleasant one. It doesn't make us feel good. It doesn't make me feel good. Especially the lecture that I'm going to present tonight, talking about what it would be like and whether it is likely to happen. You know, it's not a pleasant kind of thing to talk about anywhere, certainly not in this glorious spot. And I don't want us to have a sense of hopelessness or of total fear, because I don't think that's an appropriate response. At the same time, I think we need to face facts squarely. I would have to say that as I've worked on this book, a deeper level of pessimism has crept into my own being, but I'm not in despair. I believe that we can avoid nuclear holocaust in the next 25 years. There's a little saying that says that the nuclear war is impossible, says the optimist. Nuclear war is inevitable, says the pessimist. Nuclear war is inevitable unless we make it impossible, says the realist. And that's about where I'm at. I think that there's probably a better than a 50-50 chance that we'll have nuclear war in the next 25 years. At the same time, I believe that if within the Church of Jesus Christ, a fundamental movement for change can emerge, and that's happening, thank God, then I think that we can avoid that. And I want to do all I can to work in that direction. I think that working on this book has deepened my love of the earth. It's happened for several reasons in my own life in the last couple of years. One part of it is just that I thought 2 years ago that I had a heart problem for about 1 week. The first person who looked at some tests told me that I had a problem, and the next person that looked at them said, no, there's no problem at all. But in that intervening week, I had a lot of sober thoughts, and we already knew that we were going to be coming here to Holden this summer. And one of the things that just really jarred me was the thought, my younger son loves to backpack, and I thought, oh my goodness, I'm never going to be able to backpack in the Cascades with Michael. The discovery that I was in great health, along with looking at the nuclear question and realizing that there's a genuine possibility that we're going to destroy this beautiful planet, has made me fall in love at a deeper level with the firs and the redwoods and the salmon and the trout and the mountains and everything else here. And I think that what God calls us to at this time is to believe that because the resurrection happened, we have solid hope, and because we know that the resurrected Lord is the one who calls us to work for peace, we have a clear command from him to make sure that what I'm going to talk about tonight does not in fact happen. What would it be like? Well, first of all, let me just briefly remind you of the weapons involved. You know very well that nuclear weapons are fundamentally different from conventional weapons. In a conventional chemical explosion, you get a temperature of, say, 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. In a nuclear blast, you get a temperature of 10 million degrees centigrade. Centigrade, of course, the scale is lower, so that's a lot more Fahrenheit. At close range, these extraordinary temperatures will just instantly burn buildings and bodies, just in a flash. Many miles away, the heat still causes serious skin burns. Nuclear weapons can also set off firestorms. A sea of fire may spread for a number of square miles. Tremendous winds at the center, and of course, high temperatures exceeding 700 degrees centigrade. Nuclear weapons also differ from conventional weapons in that they produce a great deal of radiation. Some of that kills instantly, some of it after 10 or 15 days, some of it produces cancer and so on many, many years later. The only similarity between conventional and nuclear weapons is that much of the destructive power in both cases comes from the blast. Blast is produced by the high-density, high-temperature ball of gas at the center of the explosion. This gas expands rapidly, just goes out very, very quickly, creating shock waves and high winds, many people are just thrown into walls and other kinds of things. The blast from a nuclear explosion is thousands of times more powerful than that of the largest conventional blast weapons. Just one Soviet SS-19 missile, for example, carries more destructive power than all the conventional bombs dropped in World War II. And we have weapons of the same size. The three main ways that we convey our nuclear weapons are, first of all, by intercontinental ballistic missiles, and we have a bunch of those stored in deep silos in the Midwest. We also have a bunch of submarines loaded with ballistic missiles, and we also have bombers, long-range bombers. The submarines, of course, are the most invincible, and the ones that would most likely get through in a nuclear war. Well, that's just a kind of background footnote, if you like, on the weapons. What would it be like? What if the Soviet SS-8 rocket were exploded over the White House in Washington? Imagine a circle with a radius of 1.5 miles with the White House at the center. A U.S. government study, and almost all the stuff that I'm using here in this section on what it would be like, is from U.S. government documents. The major one is the Office of Technology Assessment. They did a very important book in 1979 called The Effects of Nuclear War. The Effects of Nuclear War, the U.S. Government Office of Technology Assessment, that's available from the U.S. Government Printing Office. The government said that within the circle, 1.5 mile radius, 98% of the people would die. The Lincoln and Jefferson memorials would be leveled, the Capitol would be shattered, the Smithsonian Institute, the National Gallery of Art, the Library of Congress, et cetera, would all be destroyed immediately. Outside that circle of 1.5 mile radius, the devastation would be enormous. Buildings would collapse and burn as far as Georgetown University to the west, Washington National Airport to the south. People would suffer third-degree skin burns as far away as Alexandria, Virginia, and Tacoma Park, Maryland. With normal prevailing winds, radioactivity fallout would spread a cigar-shaped swath of sickness and death eastward across Maryland and out to Cape May to Jersey. What if a similar bomb exploded over New York City's Empire State Building? It would destroy almost all the buildings on Manhattan Island. What if the larger Soviet SS-9 rocket with its 20-megaton warhead exploded at ground level in Chicago Loop, downtown Chicago? It would crush the downtown area like a giant sledgehammer. It would exert over 1,500 times the force of the bomb that fell on Hiroshima. 1,500 times. The blast would dig a crater 1.5 miles wide and 600 feet deep. It would have a 200-foot lip that would extend almost out to Lake Michigan. Buildings would be destroyed totally and nearly everyone killed out to 4 miles from the center of the blast, from ground zero. At 7 to 8 miles along the Stevenson Expressway, oil tanks would explode, windows would shatter, trees would catch fire at Midway Airport, 10 miles from the loop, picket fences and people's skin would burn as far away as suburban Hinsdale, 16 miles from downtown Chicago. The explosion would kill 4.2 million people and seriously injure 1.7 million. All of these illustrations assume one nuclear bomb falling on the city. In an actual nuclear war, of course, the largest cities would receive almost certainly many more. For example, the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency estimated the effects of nuclear war with a computer simulation. The researchers assumed for this study that the 200 largest cities in the U.S. and Russia would each be hit by so many bombs that they would be totally destroyed. In addition, they assumed that 80% of all cities with 25,000 people or more, 80% of all cities with 25,000 people or more would be hit by at least one bomb. Now, when people hear about this, they think that perhaps there's a safer spot in rural areas. Maybe Holden is a bit safer, but most of the rural areas are not. The reason, of course, is that there are so many different strategic nuclear sites all over the country. A lot of our 1,052 missiles that are based in the silos are spread all through the Midwest, Little Rock, Arkansas, Great Falls, Montana, Wichita, Kansas, and so on. When you figure all the other key nuclear spots in Arizona and Arkansas, Indiana, Kansas, Montana, South Dakota, North Dakota, Utah, Wyoming, you know, it goes on and on. Then there are 68 strategic nuclear sites in the U.S. If we consider all the nuclear weapons located in the U.S., which Soviet rockets would probably strike, then there are 121 sites in 40 states. There is no safe place. Who would survive? What would the country be like after a nuclear war? Well, obviously you have to talk about different situations, about whether or not there was a war that was just aimed at military targets or just aimed at, say, oil installations or an all-out nuclear war. So I'll be talking about different kinds of situations. If Russia and the U.S. would limit themselves to selected military or industrial targets, then, of course, it would be less than if it was all out. Several studies have tried to figure out just what this impact would be. The U.S. Office of Technology Assessment is the one that I've especially mentioned. They say that if they just targeted oil refineries, with each country using about 80 missiles and no more, within the first hour, the report concluded, the Soviet attack would kill 3 million to 5 million Americans. The American attack would kill 1 to 5 million Russians. 68% of the U.S. oil capability would be destroyed. Suppose that we just aimed at strictly military installations. Then, under the best imaginable circumstances, that is, you know, fewest people in the area, the right prevailing winds, et cetera, et cetera. If you assumed all of the best circumstances, then it might be limited to 1 million people in each country. But under less favorable circumstances, then it would be 20 million people in the U.S., 10 million people in Russia, and significant portions of both countries would be covered by fallout. Now, the figures I've given you thus far assume a limited nuclear war. I think that it's extremely unlikely that if we start shooting nuclear weapons across the oceans at each other, that we'll stop. Someone has suggested that if they took out Detroit, we took out Leningrad, then we could stop and have lunch and figure out where to go from there. I think that's doubtful. I think we would probably go all the way at that point. And if we did go all the way, then, of course, it would be much, much worse. Best available government data says that a very large attack against a range of just military and economic targets. Now, this is a large attack, not just a very limited one. Large against military and economic targets would kill 70 to 160 million Americans. And if it was total, if we aimed at cities, then we'd have 190 million Americans killed and about 130 million Russians, a large percent of both populations. Medical care after that kind of war would be devastated. Rescue work would be almost impossible. In any built-up location, thousands of survivors would be trapped as they were in Hiroshima, under collapsed buildings. Heavy equipment, which would normally go through and get people out, of course, could not go through the clogged streets. Much of that equipment would have been destroyed anyway. When they got to hospitals, there would be very few hospitals available. One of the problems is that a lot of the hospitals are located in downtown areas, and a lot of the medical personnel during the day are in the same area. And so a lot of those folk and the facilities get destroyed. In Hiroshima, in 1945, 270 of the city's 298 doctors were killed immediately. 270 out of 298. The city's 18 hospitals and 32 first aid stations were all destroyed. There was one Red Cross hospital out at the edge, and thousands of people swarmed to that one hospital where a few doctors tried to take care of the people. In both, as I said, both Russia and the U.S., the medical people tend to be in the downtown areas, and they get killed. The drug pharmaceutical industry is also in near city areas, and that's one of the eight industries that's targeted for destruction by both sides, so that there would be virtually no drugs around. Perhaps the most severe problem would be the burns. The entire U.S. has 12 burn centers. They can handle a maximum of 2,000 severe burns at any one time. Just one nuclear explosion could produce 10,000 severe burn cases. An all-out nuclear war would probably create 25 million severe burn cases. Sanitation after a nuclear war would be virtually non-existent. Water and sewer would mix together. Disease would spread from unburied corpses. Epidemics would be carried by viruses, bacteria, and insects, which are much more resistant to radiation than we are. Old pestilences like plague, cholera, influenza, cholera, typhus, and typhoid would spread throughout the world. Radiation itself, of course, would be devastating. It would kill some people instantly. About 20% of the people would die from exposure to radiation, hospitals and first aid stations would be swamped by people who would be coming in vomiting and wrenched with diarrhea. Some would die almost immediately. Some would live for a few days or even a couple weeks. But after a week or so, their hair would fall out, they would become weak and feverish, ulcers would form in their skin, and they would bleed internally and finally die after enormous pain. Even where people were not killed instantly or after a couple weeks from radiation, there would, of course, be longer-term effects. It can cause cancer and genetic problems. Leukemia and other cancers crop up after exposure to radiation. The Japanese discovered in Hiroshima that the leukemia rate in the mid-50s, 10 or so years after Hiroshima, the leukemia rate, death rate, was 30 times higher than for the rest of the country. Scientists have established a direct correlation between exposure to nuclear radiation and the incidence of cancer, the thyroid, breast, lung, and salivary glands. A U.S. government study estimated that cancer deaths in the millions could be expected during the 40 years following a large-scale nuclear attack, even if that attack avoided population centers. If we had a total nuclear war, it would blanket all of the middle Atlantic states, much of the southeast, much of the Midwest, New England, of course, and large areas of the west, with radiation levels which the government said, and I quote, would cause incapacitating radiation illness to all and kill many. Now, if you follow those areas, you'll note that's most of the country. Basic human needs after a nuclear war could not be met. There would be the desperate problems of food and housing and clothing and other necessities. 90% of the urban and a lot of the rural housing would be destroyed. Fuel and energy needed for cooking and for other farm things would be destroyed. Food production would be greatly reduced. There would be damage to feedlots, to animals, and so on. Industry and banking would probably be even more devastated. According to the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking, industry would suffer an even more devastating blow than agriculture. The missiles carried in 5 or 6 submarines have enough firepower to eliminate all the industries on which a modern society depends. A government computer estimated that from 65 to 90% of the key industrial capacity of the U.S., and Russia would be destroyed. They pointed out that survivors would be in an awful situation because with a lot of the plant destroyed, with a lot of the skilled technicians gone, they would have to restore the basic operation before the available stocks that were still left were used up. If the rest of that stock, the materials that had been made before the nuclear war, were used up before they got things running again, then every year, of course, would see a downward spiral. If they managed to restore things before they used up those supplies, then you might find an early modern industrial civilization emerging. In response to the turmoil, it's almost certain that democracy as we know it would disappear. The environment might be devastated, almost certainly would be devastated in a lot of ways. I'll talk just about the ozone layer. The National Academy of Sciences estimated that a war using 1/2 of the strategic nuclear weapons held by Russia and the U.S. would reduce the ozone layer in the northern hemisphere by 30 to 70%. The ozone layer, you know, is that special form of oxygen which screens out the ultraviolet rays. Now, with that much of the ozone gone, a person going out into the sun for 30 minutes would get a blistering burn on any exposed skin. Probably all animals would be blinded, and of course they would therefore die. When the combined effects of all of these disasters are added together, some scientists think that all human life would come to an end and the Earth would be left to the cockroaches, who are 400 times more resistant to radiation than we are. Others believe that the planet would eventually become inhabited by roving bands of humanoids. Others think that some human beings would survive, but perhaps at a level comparable to the life of the Middle Ages. Others, a few, much more optimistic, think that after that kind of shattering blow, some kind of long-term recovery to a level of a modest industrial state would be possible. Well, that, briefly, using U.S. government data, is a bit of what a nuclear war would be like. I'd like to take another, perhaps 10 minutes, no more, to ask the question, is it likely? Now, what's the possibility that it would happen? And then that'll give us a good 20, 25 minutes for discussion. I hope you'll share, ask questions, and so on. How might nuclear deterrence break down? Now, it is a fact that for 30-plus years, deterrence, which is the current policy, which is that if we have weapons of awful destruction and the Russians have weapons of awful destruction, then we'll both be afraid to use them because we know that we'll get destroyed too, and deterrence will work, and we'll not have nuclear war. Thus far, that's worked. We've come fairly close in the Cuban Missile Crisis, very close in the Cuban Missile Crisis. If you read Robert Kennedy's autobiography, you'll note that Kennedy says that in the White House, they had come to the conclusion that we would have a nuclear war, and Kennedy was ready to do that. Well, there are at least five ways, I'm sure there are more, in which deterrence could break down. I want to just mention those. First of all, deterrence could break down, and we could have nuclear war if there could be, if there was a breakdown, a mental breakdown, on the part of the many, many people who are involved in the handling of nuclear weapons. There are over 100,000 U.S. military personnel involved in programs with access to or control over nuclear weapons. From 1975 to 77, those 3 years, the Defense Department's Personnel Reliability Program removed over 15,000 people from their posts, people who were involved with the handling of nuclear weapons. They were removed because of alcohol abuse, drug abuse, and other aberrant behavior. That's about 5,000 people a year who are handling nuclear weapons. The commanders of our Trident submarines have the power to devastate the Soviet Union. One of our Trident submarines could destroy every city in Russia, over 100,000 people. What if our commanders, or the commander of a Soviet sub, were to lose emotional balance under the pressure of a crisis? Now, there are two people, two commanders on our subs, and there are, of course, all kinds of complex backup arrangements to prevent an accident. But it is the case that, as Admiral Powell Carter, Navy Director of Strategic and Theater Nuclear Warfare, admitted a couple years ago, that under certain circumstances, commanders of our submarines can fire their missiles without receiving orders to do so.
Another possibility is technological malfunction. The computers and all of the complex machinery that we have might break down and lead to disaster. Take the recent example on November the 9th, 1979. NORAD is the computer and tracking center in Colorado, which receives satellite and radar and other information about possible Soviet attacks. And it's from there that the U.S. would signal to subs out in the ocean and so on for a response. Now, one of the things that they regularly do, one of the exercises they regularly do at NORAD, is a computer simulation of an actual Russian attack. It's a war game, they call it. And this kind of computerized war game helps U.S. military planners decide how they would respond in different military situations. On November the 9th, a computer tape, which simulates one of these Russian attacks, accidentally got fed into the whole U.S. warning system by mistake. U.S. military forces were placed on alert. Air Force fighters and interceptors took off in search of the Russian planes that were thought to be attacking, Russian missiles. Commercial airplanes were notified to get ready to land. About 3 to 5 minutes later, they discovered that it was a mistake. 7 months later, on June the 3rd, 1980, another computer error warned that the Soviet Union had launched submarine and land-based missiles at the U.S. U.S. defenses were again put on alert. And the people that are down in the silos strapped themselves into their shock-resistant seats, prepared to turn their keys to launch their missiles. In both cases, they discovered, after a lot of careful search, that what had gone wrong was a 46-cent computer chip, which had misfunctioned. Now, in both of those cases, and in a third one, rather similar, the error was discovered within 3 to 6 minutes. But 3 to 6 minutes is a very long time when you remember that Russian subs off the coast, the East Coast or the West Coast, can hit Washington or Seattle or L.A. within a matter of 5 minutes. What if that kind of computer failure would have happened at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis or at the height of some other crisis? Soviet computers are probably not as advanced as our own. They undoubtedly malfunction too. Follow-ups of this sort are by no means unique. Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona did a careful study and discovered that in an 18-month period, there were 147 false alarms in the nuclear system. So computer malfunction, then, is a second way, computer or other technological malfunction, that we could unwittingly get into nuclear war. The third possibility is the first strike capability that's being developed by both the U.S. and Russia. We're both deploying highly accurate missiles which might be able, down the road a little while, to wipe out all of the enemy's missiles before they were launched. At least that's what both sides are working for. Precisely guided missiles are now being produced that are accurate to within 100 feet or so after going from here to Russia, or vice versa, 8,000 miles or so. Military planners can target them to destroy missile silos, command posts, communication systems, bomber bases, submarine pens. Both sides are working feverishly on anti-submarine weapons, which, when combined with underwater sensing devices, might be able to locate and destroy subs at sea. Neither side has that capability now, thank God. But both sides are working on first-strike weapons. And, of course, the Trident, with its very accurate missiles, does give us a limited first-strike possibility. The fourth way it might happen would be through limited nuclear war. Some military planners have suggested in the last few years that it might be possible to survive a nuclear war. Some of the current president's top planners have suggested that we could have a limited exchange and then stop. I think that fighting a limited nuclear war is something like agreeing to fight with one arm held behind your back. If you're losing, you bring out the other hand rather quickly. Former President Carter, Secretary of Defense, Harold Brown, said, with reference to limited nuclear war, I quote, "To me it seems very unlikely almost to the point of impossibility. It is much more like that it's almost impossible that we would have a limited war and then stop. He goes on and says, it is much more likely to me that if a few strategic weapons were fired, it would then escalate to larger and larger exchanges that would end up in an all-out thermonuclear war that would destroy both countries. And the admiral of the British fleet, Lord Lewis Mountbatten, said in 1979, I can see no use for any nuclear weapons which would not end in escalation with consequences no one can conceive. Could deterrence break down? The answer is yes, it certainly could. I can't sit here and tell you how likely it is. But any number of factors, an escalating crisis, technological malfunction, the ability to strike first without retaliation, possibility of a limited nuclear war for whatever reason, and of course proliferation. By the end of this century, there'll be several dozen third world countries and industrial nations that have nuclear weapons. When Billy Graham visited the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz, he said, is a nuclear holocaust inevitable if the arms race is not stopped? Frankly, the answer is almost certainly yes. Now, I know that some people feel human beings are so terrified of a nuclear war that no one would dare start one. I wish I could accept that. But neither history nor the Bible, Billy said, gives much reason for optimism. The present insanity of the global arms race, if continued, he concluded, will lead inevitably to a conflagration so great that Auschwitz will seem like a minor rehearsal. Admiral Hyman G. Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy in the U.S., the man who's built over the last 30 years the powerful nuclear navy that we have, retired early this year. And when he retired, he said that unless we get rid of our nuclear weapons, we'll destroy ourselves. And then he added somewhat pessimistically, I think we probably will destroy ourselves. That's as accurate a picture of the world we live in on this issue as I can present. I'm glad to try to discuss this with you, to answer questions. Please feel free to raise questions, put an alternative viewpoint.
Yeah. Before coming to Holden, we visited a relative who's a real survivalist down near Portland, and was building a bomb shelter out of a one-inch reinforcing rod to withstand 400-mile-an-hour winds when the bomb hit Portland. And I said, why would you want to live through it? Because of the radiation afterward. He made the statement that all nuclear weapons are isotopes of iodine, which has a half-life of 3.8 days or something, and after a month or so, he could go out and clean up what was left and so on. I'm so ignorant on this whole issue, I just, you know, it seemed like an insane statement to me. But, do you happen to know anything about the makeup of these nuclear weapons?
That's not right.
That seemed right, yeah.
The U.S. government did a careful study of how successful the shelters that the Russians have built in Moscow would be, and they indicated that if the shelters somehow managed to survive, and if somehow their ventilation systems managed not to get any radiation into them, that people would have to stay in them a month without going out at all, and would have to stay in them another month going out just a few hours a day. And even then you'd need Geiger counters. I mean, some of the radiation will be harmful for much, much longer than that.
The Pacific tests are a good example of that. We moved the people 200 miles from our tests of weapons in the Pacific, were evacuated from their homes after they got the fallout. And they were moved back several years later because the government had determined that it was safe for them to live on their home islands. After they started getting thyroid cancer like mad, they moved them back off of the islands, and now they're saying it will be a minimum of 30 years from now. The contract that we're negotiating with Micronesia right now to make reparations to them for this is based on the assumption that it will be a minimum of 30 more years before it will be safe for them to move back onto their islands and eat anything that has grown there at all.
I live in a community of about 11,000 people north of Seattle, about an hour's drive, and apparently, according to the government plan, that when and if the nuclear bombs hit Seattle, approximately 300,000 people are to be evacuated to our valley, which is a rather large valley, and then another 300,000 to a valley about 30 miles north of us. Now, I've been in Seattle at 5 o'clock on Friday. under normal conditions. And my question is, I don't understand how people in high governmental positions can use that kind of logic. I mean, it's so insane, but yet that's the governmental plan. I mean,
the person in charge of evacuation procedures for the government testified sometime in the last year before the Congress, and he was asked how much time he would need, how much advance warning he would need in order to do the evacuation procedures he was suggesting. He said, about 8 days. I don't think there's any word to use for that except deception. It seems to me that what the government's trying to do is to make us feel more comfortable with nuclear weapons and to talk about evacuation procedures is, they hope, to make us feel they're doing something. But there's nothing that can be done. It's insane to think that you can have an evacuation process when it takes 30 minutes for the intercontinental ballistic missiles to go one place to another, and you're not going to have 8 days of warning.
I saw a movie put out by physicians, and one of the statements in that movie by a physician was that he felt it would be totally immoral and unethical for a physician to participate in any civil defense activities because it was an implication that it would be possible to survive a nuclear holocaust, and that they should pay no attention to even cultivating any kind of minor hope that it was possible to survive, because it just sort of further deadens people. You think you can survive, you really don't get quite as violently opposed to the whole nuclear arms buildup.
The man, the physician in Canada, who was in this comparable position of the head doctor for survival kinds of things, recently resigned and said there's nothing to be done except buy morphine. Philadelphia, I'm proud to say, I think it was the first major city in the country that refused to accept any federal funds for evacuation procedures. It happened a few months ago.
What are the differences between your book and Jonathan Shell's?
As you'll see in the following lectures, I go on and ask, what I've shared here is just the first one quarter or less of the book. I then go on and ask, okay, what's the Christian response? And I try to develop, first of all, there have been two streams in the Christian church on the whole question of war and violence. One is the just war tradition, and the other is question, the position of pacifism or nonviolence. And I will argue that both of those traditions come to the same conclusion on the nuclear question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which part of the world do you feel is the safest place to be?
Well, the southern hemisphere is certainly vastly safer than the northern. So if you feel called to be a missionary in the southern hemisphere, that's... I think that one scenario is that the northern hemisphere would be largely wiped out and may not inhabitable, but the southern hemisphere might conceivably survive, but that, when you talk about the long-range ecological impact, that's not necessarily the case. But we just don't know enough to really speak to tell about that sort of thing. There's no safe place in the U.S.
Could I? You presented your credentials at the beginning. I'll present mine. I'm a very confused Christian. and a recently retired colonel from the Army. What you've outlined in terms of effects, worst case, and so forth, I can't argue with. I've studied nuclear effects, weapons effects. I could nitpick some of your arguments, and I see no point in that. I can't share the opinion you apparently have that worst case would ever take place. I don't have a high opinion of my fellow human being, especially my fellow Russian human being. I have enough faith in my fellow human being, including that Russian, to believe that that the leadership of the two countries, or any other country, is unlikely, if not, I really don't see responsible leadership ever bringing about the total war, nuclear war circumstance that you're describing. As far as the accident is concerned, I think in presenting the potential for accident, you presented some very good arguments for that accident not occurring. The fact that they have indeed discovered it. The fact that a Russian attack from the coastal waters of the United States, we're talking minutes, very few minutes, in spite of that fact, there was sufficient time to detect that 45-cent computer chip error that you described. I think there's some arguments to be made that we do indeed have some pretty serious safeguards. In your introductory statement, Jimmy Carter obviously convinced you that he indeed meant what he said, that if the Russians were to attack us with nuclear weapons, he would retaliate. And I submit that it is only as long as that conviction exists that we can be reasonably assured that the situation will not occur. Now, I'm going through quite a transition in my life for a number of reasons. And I've heard the Christian argument that I would rather be red than dead in a nuclear holocaust. And I'm not sure how I personally am going to deal with that kind of statement. I haven't gotten that far yet. I'm here because that's where I am now, and I want to hear things like this. But I can't entirely accept the scenario that you're describing to me. So.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your sharing that. I devoutly hope you're right. I sure don't want it to happen.
I would say that the credibility of the book that you're writing, if it's not entirely completed, it certainly would be greater if you would point out some of the facts, like you mentioned, that the very fact that it hasn't happened up to now because of safeguards, gives us some glimmer of hope. But always presenting it strictly in a negative way. Sounds too much like a newspaper article that is going out after, the sensationalism. I think there is some hope, even though it's a very slight glimmer. There is at least a glimmer of hope that in the last, 30, 35 years, that it, the second one hasn't been detonated, the third one. And there are safeguards that at least there's some, intent on the part of the authorities to safeguard against it, even though that may only be a glimmer of hope. At least it's a glimmer.
I have a hard time believing that we'll ever have another nuclear war other than a total war. I have a feeling that if a nuclear bomb explodes in Moscow or in New York or in Los Angeles or almost any other major target in the world, that virtually all the rest of the nuclear weapons that are in place ready to be fired will be fired right now. My logic for that is that, let's boil it down to this moment for either to Russia and the United States, although remembering that anybody else who has one can be the one that starts it, because if one lands, more will be in the air before anybody's figured out who started the first one. And if we believe that Russia has fired one bomb over us, and we know they've got what for practical purposes is unlimited power to destroy us. We're not going to wait and find out if they're just threatening us. We're going to do everything we can to kill them before they kill us, and they're going to do the same thing in like circumstances to us. I cannot believe in a limited nuclear war. If we didn't have the bombs here, or had only a smattering of them, and Russia knew or believed that we had only a few of them, say something like we had for Nagasaki and Hiroshima, then they might not give that type of a retaliation, because it's only their fear that we can kill them and that we now have a sudden reason to do so that would make them act in a like manner to us. And I don't think their motivation would be significantly different than ours in those circumstances. Sure, we're a different kind of a country than they are. But in an emergency, we're going to react an awful lot alike.
I certainly think that the top concern of the leaders of both countries is to avoid a nuclear war. I don't have any doubt about that. And I don't think that the leaders in either country would plan an all-out war. I think it's conceivable that one side might make a breakthrough and develop enough first strike capability that they thought they could wipe out the other side's military, all their nuclear weapons. I think that's conceivable either way. I can conceive of the president doing that, and I can conceive of the Russians doing that. That, of course, would be a very dangerous situation, because both sides know enough about the other side in terms of spying. They would probably know that at least some of that first strike capability was being developed, and so they might be tempted to launch a preemptive strike before the other side got all their first strike in place. Another part of the danger is the whole wanton warning thing. Because the response time is getting shorter, there's the possibility that both sides would put their nuclear weapons on an automatic wanton warning, so that in fact the decision could be made by computer, because they think there's insufficient time for a human decision there.
Would you speak to the issue that we've been building up nuclear armaments for 20-some plus years, and
30-some,
and why we have waited this long, or why have we waited this long to do something? Why is today more critical than 10 years ago, 5 years ago?
Some others may want to come in on that too. I think that part of that's an imponderable kind of a historical psychology. It's okay.
First strike capability.
Well, I certainly shot out of my chair. I was heading straight for my bomb shelter. Let me just say another word or so on that one. I think that part of the current concern is due quite directly to the political decisions in the last 2 years in our own country. The discussion about the possibility of surviving a limited nuclear war at pretty high levels in the Reagan administration, and the massive military expenditures, that all of that goes way beyond what the American people really want, and that Reagan is probably more responsible than anything for the current widespread concern for the nuclear arms race. Another piece of it is that, Senator Hatfield, I think, would answer the question. He's been concerned about it for a long time, and he would say that it's especially dangerous now because we are moving to develop and install MX missile cruise missiles, which are very, very accurate, and therefore are potentially first strike weapons. As long as the basic policy, which it was for a couple decades, is that if they attack us, we'll just bomb them
into obliteration and kill their city and knock out all their cities, their population. The weapons weren't terribly accurate. They didn't have to be for that. But when you get weapons that can hit within 100 feet or so, then you can target all their military installations. And of course, you don't aim at military installations to hit them after their missiles are out of there. So even if you don't claim to be going for first strike, you in fact have that capability.
The whole time sequence is going to go down another scale as satellite weapons, laser type thing, take it from 5 minutes to 10 seconds. So if you're operated there, you're going to shoot the other guy's laser beam down.
Let's stop. Let's just end with prayer.